It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. There is a school of thought out there that says the next 9/11 attack, if there is to be one, won't be the crude kind involving planes crashing into buildings, but rather something more sophisticated and just as sinister and covert, a devastating computer attack that unplugs the power grid, empties bank accounts, and results in loss of life. While that may still be a far-fetched scenario, the evidence shows that critical infrastructure in the United States is being targeted by hackers, and the nation is clearly in need of cybersecurity solutions. Our guest, reporter Andrew Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune-Review, has written a two-part series this week that talks about Pittsburgh's role in cyber defense, including the nation's first computer emergency response team at Carnegie Mellon University's Software Engineering Institute. Andrew Conti, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about this. 412-246-2002 is the number to call if you have a comment or a question about what kinds of cybersecurity breaches may or may not be taking place, and how devastating they can potentially be. What is the government? What are places like Carnegie Mellon University's Cyber Defense Institute doing to help us combat these attacks? 412-246-2002 is the number to call. That's 412-246-2002. Email ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. Andrew Conti, who is behind most cyber attacks?
So the hackers, and there are different kinds. There's some that are, you know, just the individual hacker that you think of from the old movies in the 1980s, you know, the kid sitting in his room just doing it. Up to, you know, hacktivists trying to get out a message. There are the criminals, and then there are the nation states. You know, and that's what we were really focused on in this story, where the nation states with the resources to go out and, you know, potentially launch a major attack. I got to tell you, I've gotten a lot of pushback since the story came out on Sunday and the Tribune Review. Well, people saying to me, you know, this is just hype, right? I mean, this is just trying to get people excited in order to, you know, if you're a defense contractor.
You point this out in your series. You say that that some contend the warnings of imminent and devastating cyber attacks are hype, designed to scare the public and raise money for the defense industry and help cybersecurity experts win consulting contracts. Well, so what about it?
Right. And I mean, for me, it's I'm a reporter, right? I go out and I talk to the experts. And so I went to CERT over at CMU, the world's first computer emergency response team. Last week, I was at the U.S. Army War College, and I was granted access to sit in on this session they had all week for top military minds. I was the only reporter in the room, and they were talking about – people there were talking about being prepared for not having electricity for up to a year or 2 years. I mean, that's serious stuff, and clearly they're planning for a worst-case scenario, but it's the kind of thing that it at least opened my eyes and made me say, you know, we should pay attention to this.
Well, of course, that's going to open your eyes. But what is the likelihood? I mean, you're talking about the power grid being shut down for a year in the United States. I mean, certainly somebody is anticipating an attack of this magnitude and would be prepared, if not for the attack, for some sort of contingency plan to get the power up and running again, right?
Well, there's that. And I think the discussion here is about the possibility. You know, these things are possible. That's what the experts seem to agree. Yes, somebody could break in and they could shut down the power grid. And then there's the feasibility of it. Would somebody actually do it? You know, if you look at the nation states, you think, well, perhaps the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, even the North Koreans, they might have the capability to pull this off, but none of them really has the desire to do it. They're as connected as we are, right? They're, if you're a Russian cyber criminal, you don't want to take down the internet because that's where you get all your money. It's where you're stealing credit cards from. But the concern is, you know, what if ISIS gets this capability, right? And they don't care. You know, they would love to send us back to the Stone Ages. Then what do you do in that case? And so it's kind of a race to stay in front of that type of hacker.
But could they really? I mean, it's conceivable, certainly, that that power could be shut down. But for a year, could we really be sent back to the Stone Age by ISIS?
That's what these experts at the War College seem to believe. I need to do some more research in it. There's some issue with there's a certain level of critical transformers, and if they go down, then it's hard to replace, and that's where you're left with
And what would what are the conditions or the scenarios that would even make it possible for power grids to be down that long? What would have to take place? And how does that what does the reality of that how does that compare with the capability that's out there?
Right. So it would have to be this is like a really extreme case. It'd have to be a massive, a hacker who has already mapped out the systems, knows where to go in, is able to shut down critical transformers, shut down critical, electrical systems at nuclear facilities across the country. That seems really hard to believe. But what you do see, and that's what, I based the story on, was that we kept getting more and more reports. If you look at these are classified reports, but they're just under the level of, sending the messages out to the public. So they're not deep classified. But the Homeland Security back in November sent out a warning. Hey, there are Russians out there. These hackers have put in, malware onto industrial control systems. And then a couple of weeks later, there's another one. Oh, the Iranians have been probing into industrial systems across the United States. It's the kind of thing that opens your eyes. And what we found with the story was that there were lots of things that never were intended to be linked to the internet that are now linked to the internet, these industrial systems. And then there are things that people link up there and they don't really realize that they're broadcasting the information out. It's as simple as we looked at, there's this one search engine. You can look for it. And it's just webcams that people have set up in their homes, in their businesses. There was a computer repair shop outside of Philadelphia. You could see in the back office. You would think these guys would know better, but you could see right into, where the employees were, stuff that they didn't want the public to see, but they were broadcasting anyway.
Right. And so some of the things that have made access to our own computers and accounts more convenient for us have created the entryway for hackers for a cyber attack?
Absolutely. And what's interesting about that is that the folks that first set up the ARPANET back in the 1980s, and that's when the first self-replicating worm came out in 1988. It was this – all these guys were – there were only 60,000 people connected to the internet. And all of a sudden, they start getting phone calls at the DARPA headquarters, the defense military agency that does advanced research. And they start getting phone calls, something's wrong with ARPANET. There's something out there. And so they go and they find that it's this worm that's self-replicating. And when it all settles down, they get it figured out, that's when they decide we need to have some kind of center where we can deal with these. And that's where they end up choosing Carnegie Mellon's Software Engineering Institute, which is a defense contractor. And that's where they came and they set up the first computer emergency response team. And now there are more than 300 of them around the world, but the first was here in Pittsburgh.
And the one at CMU is called CERT, and again, that stands for?
Computer Emergency Response Team.
And how many security breaches are they increasing?
Yeah. I mean, there's some websites where you can look at, attempted breaches and attempted hacks, and Dave Hickton, the U.S. attorney here for Western Pennsylvania, he was just talking about it last week. They had an event that was simultaneous with the president's cybersecurity summit at Stanford. And he talked about it there where you can, he clicked off his fingers and you could see these attacks happening all the time. And the thing is the attackers are getting more sophisticated.
What about the ones that go undetected? How many are there that we don't even know about?
Right. I mean, who knows? But that's one of the fascinating things when you get into this and you're sitting in a room with, there was an event in the fall where it was retailers, and then this event with even the military last week. And the thing that comes up is that these hackers often get inside the system and the victims don't know that they're there. This might go on for weeks or even months, and the victim doesn't realize it's happening. And at the same time, the hacker's going in and probing around the systems, finding where the weaknesses are. If it's a retail system, maybe they're looking for where the credit cards are. If it's an industrial system, they're looking for, if you're a nation state, if I choose to someday want to shut this down, how do I do it?
Mm. And there is also an aspect of this that is there are probably more hackers that go undetected, but they don't always get away clean. There are those that, leave traces.
Right. Absolutely. I mean, the most famous example is the Stuxnet was the malware that was created perhaps by, they think by the Americans and the Israelis that was used to destroy the centrifuges in the Iranian nuclear program. And that was something where, it was designed to go in, create all this havoc and disappear, and, you know, they got caught with it.
We're talking with Andrew Conti of the Pittsburgh Tribune Review, who has been writing extensively, if you follow his work at all in the Trib, he has written extensively about cyber defense issues, his most recent two-part series this week, talking about Pittsburgh's role in cyber defense, including the nation's first computer emergency response team at Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. To join the conversation, 412-246-2002, the number to call. Let's go to Jacob in Highland Park. Hello, Jacob.
Hi. Yep. So I guess a question. I know you mentioned Stuxnet. With the exception of Stuxnet, can you point to any large-scale hacks on SCADA or other industrial control systems that are connected to the Big I Internet?
Right. I mean, the tough thing is that they're – I don't have any off the top of my head, but the thing is that they're happening, and oftentimes it's the same that we found with the banking industry, is that companies don't talk about it. If you're a victim and you've had somebody get inside your system, they never talk about it. But what we hear instead is the – you know, it's the government standing up and saying, hey, this is going on. And that's where I mentioned the alert we had back in December about the FBI sent out. It was a classified alert, but it was saying, hey, be aware, these – Iranian, you know, computers from Iran are being used to hack into industrial control systems. And that was a case where they actually were inside the systems and the FBI had detected it. Hmm.
Jacob, thank you for that question. Let's go to Kurt in, he says, south of Pittsburgh. Hi, Kurt.
How are you doing?
Well, thank you. Go ahead with your comment or question.
I was wondering if it's a possibility that, you know, the intelligence agency could contract out to Anonymous, the hacking group.
I think what you're, what you're really talking about is, can the United States have a strong offensive capability? I think, you know, because we talk about it generally here in the States about, well, there's the Chinese and the Russians and, you know, all these other groups. We never hardly ever talk about the United States and its offensive capabilities. But if you, you know, and the people who know that I've talked with say, you know, they don't like to talk about it, but when people come out of it, they say, you know, who's number one? Of course the United States is number one. We're the best at this, you know, doing it to companies in other countries around the world. Now, what you know, the line that's differentiated here is that the United States doesn't go out and steal industrial secrets for its companies.
You know, as far as we know.
As far as we know, right? But it's not like the United States owns these companies where, you know, you see that in other countries where, you know, where the – country actually owns the nuclear facilities and might go out and steal the information and just hand it off.
What sorts of cyber attack activity is the U.S. engaged in? I know people don't want us to know, but what – I mean, what are we doing?
Well, we don't know, right? I mean, you have to sort of assume that the United States is doing the same thing that these other countries are doing to us, right? So if these other countries are coming in and they're probing industrial systems and they're figuring out where the weaknesses are – what they're doing is laying the groundwork for, you know, if we ever get to a state of warfare, that would be part of the attack, right? That would be part of, you know, at the same time you're launching missiles or sending tanks across the border, you would also be shutting down whatever systems you could on the computer. You have to believe the United States is doing the same exact thing to prepare for that sort of situation.
Did the United States, in response to the North Korean, allegedly it was the North Koreans who hacked Sony, and the Obama administration became very indignant about that. And coincidence or not, North Korea's internet went – the whole country's internet went down not long after that. And the United States did not confirm or deny that they were responsible, that this country was responsible for that. What do you know about that, Andrew?
It was really fascinating. That was a key part of the discussion at the U.S. Army War College last week when I was there. Because that's a situation where it started out as something that was a crime. You know, somebody had hacked into a private company, Sony Entertainment, and, you know, this is a Japanese company, but this is their United States subsidiary, so it's a U.S. company. And then, you know, the president steps out and says, well, this was an attack by – he calls it an attack, and he says it's from a foreign adversary. Well, now it becomes a question of, you know, is this something that requires a military response? And what do you do in that case? Is it the kind of thing where – if it causes $15 million in damage and it's online, is it the same as if a country – what if a country had come here and put off a bomb in a parking lot at Sony and it caused $15 million in damage? Is it the same thing? And the discussion at the War College that I was, you know, privy to, and it was an unclassified discussion. So they didn't talk about the offensive capabilities and what really happens. But the discussion was that it's not the same, that it's not really, you know, it's you have to we have to come up with new rules and new policy for dealing with these types of situations.
Well, it did cause a lot of damage, and it would seem to be kind of an arbitrary thing to measure that damage. It cost the head of Sony Pictures her career, or at least her job at Sony. It was a security breach and an invasion of privacy that, if nothing else, was extremely embarrassing to individuals that our Constitution is designed to protect against. So, really, how do you adequately measure that? And if you're basing the measurement on the response from the United States, you want to mess with us? We'll shut down your whole damn internet. What about that in terms of the message it sends to countries in the rest of the world?
So there's two things on that. One, there were defense contractors who were at this event last week too, and they were saying, you know, now is when you're going to do a response. You know, we're attacked all the time, but now Hollywood's attacked and it's out in the open. So now this is where we draw a line in the sand. And the other
is
part,
it a perception thing? You know,
well,
in other
surely
words,
it was.
I mean, because it's a high profile hack. Does it require that kind of response?
You know, these similar hacks happen all the time, and we don't hear about them. But in this case, because it involved celebrities and Hollywood actors, and it became something that was, you know. And then you had on top of that where Sony said, well, we're not going to show the movie. We're going to, you know, we're not going to release the interview.
Right.
And now it becomes, you know, a part of the public discussion. But yeah, the question is, what do you do in response to that? And there's a robust discussion out there about do you do something like shutting down their internet, or do you actually make a kinetic attack? You know, do you go and drop bombs there? Do you do something that sends a message? And I mean, it's a fascinating area, but I think it's also the kind of thing where you have to take a measured response to it.
And the interview was eventually released. Did you go see it?
Yeah, I did. I tried watching it with my 15-year-old son and my father-in-law. It's like it's a total disaster.
Oh,
have you watched the movie?
I have.
Okay. So try to – Matt, you've got your 15-year-old son on one side and your father-in-law on the other side.
That would be interesting. Were they laughing, I guess, is with the bottom line.
There were like awkward silences. It was very – a lot of awkward silences.
We're talking with Andrew Conti of the Tribune Review, who writes about cybersecurity issues. And we have an email at our address, I should mention, is ESSPGH@WESA.FM. You can also call us at 412-246-2002. We have an email from Audrey who says, I'm reading this cold, among many other things, it is definitely time for legislators to stop promoting internet and other electronic voting as a way to make voting popular. Due to our votes necessarily remaining secret, while the voter needing to be identified, online voting could open the country to a massive takeover by vote-stealing outsiders. Already, many of our military and overseas voters have been given electronic voting by several states. They vote through internet provided by foreigners. This is a very interesting question. Based on Audrey's comments, should electronic voting be a cybersecurity concern?
Every time I hear something like that, I think hanging chads. You know, I'm thrown back to 2000.
Well, this takes it to a whole new level.
It does, right? Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's a concern, but it's the same a concern that you would have with, you know, all your banking is online as well, right? And you know, all sorts of your health information and your, you know, all your most intimate details are out there, and so. Absolutely. It should be a concern. It's something that should be addressed. You know, we don't have that kind of online voting here, but in places that do, it's a concern. And you also have to wonder about, you know, electronic voting in general. But that's a whole different discussion.
Well, what can governments and corporations do to become more secure?
Right. So they have to be more cognizant of what's happening out there. They have to be proactive. This in our story, we talk about this search engine called Shodan that, you know, you can go and search things that are connected, devices that are connected to the internet. And those are the ones that many of them are open and they're still, you know, vulnerable. Companies need to do at least some self-analysis to figure out, you know, start out there, do a search, figure out, you know, is our industrial equipment connected and vulnerable? You know, there are these guys out there that are called penetration testers. I talked to a couple of them for the story. They're guys who are hired to go and try to break into systems. If you're a company, you know, hire somebody like that. Get them in there. See if they can break into the system. See where the vulnerabilities are. For individuals and corporations, you need to update your software. You need to be on top of your passwords, changing passwords frequently. For individuals, the one that still freaks me out is that when you talk to, you know, these guys at the FBI Secret Service, they do not use their debit cards only to take cash out of the ATM machine, not for purchases all around. And I feel so dirty whenever I'm out and I use my debit card now. I'm like, oh.
Or sometimes you'll have if you want to pay a bill online and you don't have your account number, the operator, you know, who knows who it is or where they are, asks you for your social security number.
Right.
I'm guessing that the response should always be, no, I'm not going to give that to you. Can we figure out some other way to identify ourselves? What are the biggest cybersecurity risks?
So it depends on what, you know, what you're trying to cover, right? And that's what we talked about in the story when I was over at CERT and the folks there, that's where they're starting out. Instead of just having panic and feeling everybody, you know, worried about what's happening, they say start out by figuring out what your assets are. You know, what is it that you're trying to protect? What do you – if you're a corporation, you know, is it your trade secrets? Is it, you know, your internal documentation? Figure out what you want to protect and then go and do those things to protect those. And the same is true for individuals. You know, if you – you know, you want to protect your money, your information, those sorts of things. So that's – you want to identify what's out there and take steps to protect it the best you can.
How does our reliance, our increasing reliance on computers play into this?
That's what was so great about the history of the story. You know, we usually think about these things in terms of what's happening now or going forward, but it was fun to look back at the history of CERT at CMU, because in that first press release, the day that they announced that they were going to have this computer emergency response team, they made that part of the announcement was, you know, yes, this is it's already making our lives easier. Yes, they could foresee that this was going to be a growing phenomenon, although nobody could project how big it was going to get. But they were already talking there that, hey, it's a double-edged sword, right? I mean, the thing that's making our lives better is also making mm-hmm. us more vulnerable. If you think about, I mean, ARPANET, the internet, was created with the idea of making our systems more resilient, making the military more resilient, so that if one computer went down, you'd have all these other computers out there. What's fascinating to me is that as it's grown and as we've become more dependent on it, it's actually made us more vulnerable.
A tweet from Steve who says, what are some of the more likely attacks that could hit us locally? Banks? Workplaces?
Right. So, I mean, you think about already what's happened. We had last year the U.S. attorney here for Western Pennsylvania came out and talked about how major corporations in this area were already hacked, you know, that at least according to the prosecution, it was Chinese military hackers who came in and took the plans from Westinghouse and U.S. Steel and United Steelworkers. And what's fascinating when you talk about, you know, the local impact on that is that you hear the U.S. attorney and other prosecutors talking about this in terms of it's not just the company being attacked, but this undermines the economic vitality of our whole region. So that if, you know, Westinghouse is no longer selling its information, instead people are coming through the back door and just taking it, well then, you know, Westinghouse Nuclear is not going to have as many employees in our region. You can see how that spins off and puts us at a real economic disadvantage. So that's one thing. The banks here were attacked as well before. There was the denial of service attack that targeted banks, including PNC Bank here in Pittsburgh. And Dave Hickton, the U.S. attorney, made a point of bringing that up as well. And then he even goes back to the bomb threat attack at the University of Pittsburgh. And for him, that was the starting point of this whole effort to really focus on cyber, because if you remember, those threats were coming in. They were anonymous. They were coming in online. And they thought they would never be able to find out who was behind it. And they were able to figure it out by using some, you know, cyber technology, who was actually making the threats.
Andrew Conti of the Tribune Review joining us to talk about cybersecurity issues, and you can check out his two-part series online. We'll put a link to it on our website at wesa.fm, talking about Pittsburgh's role in cybersecurity, cyber defense, including the nation's first computer emergency response team at CMU's Software Engineering Institute. Andrew Conti, great. Thanks. Enjoy the conversation.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Coming up, we will talk with a Pittsburgh man who's leading a group of runners across Haiti this weekend to commemorate the fifth anniversary of the Haiti earthquake and help the citizens of that country. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. It's been 5 years since a 7.0 earthquake decimated the island of Haiti. Since then, a number of humanitarian efforts have been undertaken to help the citizens of that island nation. This weekend, a group of runners from across the United States will be doing their part to help the people of Haiti. And here to tell us how they plan to do that is Pittsburgh native Ian Rosenberger, who is founder of the nonprofit Team Tasi. Ian Rosenberger, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, we've teased listeners long enough. What are you doing to mark the anniversary of the Haiti earthquake and help the country's residents?
Yeah, sure. Well, like you said, we're 5 years after the earthquake, and progress has certainly been slow. We know, you know, certainly we work on the ground every day with the poorest of the poor in country. So this year, when we looked at what our big fundraiser was going to be, we decided that we wanted to draw attention to Haiti in a positive way, to show folks that Haiti's not a place to be scared of or pitied, but a place to visit. So we figured the best way to do that was to show people as much of the country as we could. So we decided to run from the northernmost city in Haiti on the coast to the southernmost city, and about 230 miles over 8 days.
Wow, that's a lot of mileage. 8 days, 230 miles. That's how many miles a day?
That's about 30 miles a day. Yeah, we're a special brand of crazy for sure.
That's more than a marathon a day. Who have you assembled? Who are the individuals who are even capable of thinking about doing this?
Right. I don't know if we're crazy or stupid, or maybe a little bit of both. But the team is fantastic. You know, we've been really lucky over the course of the past couple of years with Team Tasi to get a lot of support from Pittsburgh. Our executive director came to us from Pittsburgh, and a lot of the team that's running is from the area as well. Some of the folks from my job, which is CRED, which I've been on the show to talk to you about before, but also some folks from the community who've just been volunteers of ours. And when we put the word out, we got an overwhelming response. So we actually have four folks through running all 233 miles, and then another four who are running a relay. So each day they're switching off, and they're going to run a day apiece, and then do it all over again.
You're the founder of the nonprofit Team Tasi. Explain the goal here. You've addressed this to some extent, but there are some pretty lofty ambitions as part of this.
Yeah, certainly. Well, we started Team Tasi because we felt that nonprofits weren't doing as good a job as they could be serving the poor. When we really look at what it means to be poor, and you ask the poor what it is that they need, the two things that they, you know, continually come back with is education and jobs. And Tasi came to us in 2010 just needing a surgery. He had a tumor on his face when we first met him. After getting the tumor taken care of, we took him back down to Haiti. And when we got him back down to the neighborhood he's from, Cité-Soleil, we immediately realized that the entire exercise was kind of self-serving, right? Just helping to get a tumor off somebody's face, it might help Tasi for the short term, but in the long term that he was destined to the same end that most young men his age are destined to in his neighborhood, which is a short life and a violent death. So we decided to stick with him until he didn't need us anymore. And that begged the question, what does it mean for the poor not to need you any longer? And what we arrived at was a good, steady, dignified job. So we set our sights on not just preparing the poor for jobs, but actually placing them into work, finding companies who are coming down to Haiti and placing folks from one specific neighborhood in Port-au-Prince into jobs, and then tracking their progress over time. So we work with one specific neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, and the goal is if we can place about 300 people in that neighborhood, that we believe that we can help them end poverty forever in that neighborhood.
It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Our guest is Ian Rosenberger, founder of the nonprofit Team Tasi, which plans to run across Haiti this weekend to commemorate the fifth anniversary of the earthquake that devastated the country and as a means of helping citizens of the country. Why do you think running across Haiti will be an effective method of drawing attention and support to this cause?
Yeah, it's a great question. People asked us that last year. Last year we ran across Jordan in the Middle East, and that wasn't even close to what our mission was. But what it did was, when you pick a distance, it makes people take notice. You know, there's so many 5Ks and run walks. And I said, you know, what is it that we can do that's going to make people take notice? What's crazy enough that people will be like, wow, that's interesting. So we all have a passion for exercise and running, and we said, well, what better way to do it than do it in Haiti itself? So our goal here is, this is the first year. We expect to put 8 people across the finish line and raise about $75,000. And we're not going anywhere. I mean, for us, the ideal next step is to do it again next year and double the amount of participants. So for us, running was a great way to show people, particularly at this distance, that this is a country that's worth taking notice of in a positive way.
I'm guessing that running the length of the country might present a few logistical and physical challenges. Explain what those might be.
Yes, you are right. Running across the country is terribly complex. You would think it's just as easy as putting one foot in front of the other, but it definitely has proved to be more challenging than that. We have a team of 8 runners, but also a support team of about 10. One or two trucks, that one will lead the way each day and one will sweep. We have a cyclist who's running between the runners to make sure everybody's good. We have a team doctor, and we set up checkpoints along the way about every 6 or 7 miles to make sure that the runners can take on water and get checked out by the doc. So we've done our best to make sure that we kind of mitigate the risk, but it definitely is, by our accounts, an expedition. I mean, certainly it's been attempted before. We haven't heard yet if it's actually been finished, but we think that we might be the first group of multiple to run across the country. And certainly we have a woman on our team, and certainly we'll have the first woman to run across 80.
And what about the training for this event? You have been in New York, where there's been a lot of snow and cold, just like here in Pittsburgh, and you're going somewhere that's quite warm. So what do you do to get ready for that?
Yeah, that's the most difficult part, to be honest with you. You know, I train in Pittsburgh and in New York. I go back and forth. I'm back and forth between Pitt and New York every week. And you know, we've had a difficult winter. It's been cold and snowy, just as it was last winter. And I think the biggest shock to your system is once you get back into that hot weather, how difficult it is and how different your run becomes. The trick's just going to be staying hydrated. But I've done a lot of treadmill running this time. Last year I ran outside a lot. This year I've been inside, at least getting the temperature a little bit warmer. I'll try to overdress to get my body a little hotter. But overall, it's just like training for a marathon, but with longer distances.
And we've noted that it's been 5 years since that earthquake decimated Haiti. How is the country faring on its road to recovery?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, I think if you ask 10 different people, they'll give you 10 answers. Haiti has always been a place of paradox and complexity, certainly subtlety. You know, if you look at it on one side, you could look at the country and say that, you know, they're in a state of disrepair. Their president is ruling by decree. Parliament's been dissolved. There really isn't much of a government to speak of. But on the other side, you can look at it and see, even just in the work that we're doing, that, you know, job placement's taking, it's happening. Unemployment is going down. Companies are taking notice and starting to invest in country. That process is slow, but for us, you know, the trick is just to remove as many of those roadblocks as possible and to allow folks to say, hey, look, this place is not a place to be scared of. It's incredible to me, but Dominican Republic, who shares the same island as Haiti, gets around, you know, 3 or 4 million visitors each year. And Haiti, which is, like I said, the same side, or the same island, just a different side, only gets between 300,000 and 400,000 each year. It's not like it's any less pretty. So the people will come if we can create an environment where they feel safe. And so for us, you know, this is just one step, maybe, you know, hundreds of thousands of steps, I should say, just showing people that this isn't a place to be afraid of.
Ian, if there are people who want to follow the progress of this event, this endurance event that you are engaged in and Team Tossie is engaged in, where do they go to follow you?
Sure. Well, they can search us on Facebook, just Team Tossie. They can follow us on Twitter, at Team Tossie, or hashtag Run Across Haiti, or they can go to our website, which is www.teamtossie.org.
And we'll put a link to that, all of that, on our website at wesa.fm. Our guest has been Ian Rosenberger, founder of the nonprofit Team Tossie, which plans to run across Haiti this weekend to commemorate the 5th anniversary of the earthquake that devastated the country, and as a means of helping citizens of the country. Ian, safe travels. Good luck to you and your teammates.
Thank you so much.
And more Essential Pittsburgh coming up. This is 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Pittsburgh native Michael Keaton is one of five nominees for Best Actor at this year's Oscars. From producer David O. Selznick, who won an Oscar for Gone with the Wind, of course, to Best Actor nominee William Powell, pop culture contributor Joe Woes joins us for a look at Pittsburgh's connection to the Academy Awards, which, of course, are being held this Sunday. Joe Woes, welcome back to Essential Pittsburgh.
Always nice to be here.
Your upcoming piece in the Trib Review focuses on Oscar winners from Pittsburgh. How many Oscar winners have there been from the Steel City?
You know, it sort of depends on who you count as Pittsburghers.
Right. What you parameters know? Did you set up
so,
for this?
So, you know, it seems like in Pittsburgh, if you spend an hour at our airport, the city will claim you as its own. So I sort of had to dismiss, you know, if they were born here, they counted. If they, you know, they didn't just go to college for 2 years here, you know, I counted them. But if it was like, you know, they went to college at CMU for a week and then dropped out and left, I didn't count those. If they graduated and spent 4 years, I sort of counted some of those.
Okay.
So it's sort of dependent on how their connection to Pittsburgh is. But yeah, you have, you know, a handful. You have maybe about 15, you know, that won Oscars in lots of different categories and lots of different ways. There's a lot of special awards out there as well. But as far as competitive awards, you have about 15.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
That's a lot. Pittsburgh's part in the advent of the film industry was quite large. It began back in 1908 when Pittsburgh became home to the nation's first movie theater, the Nickelodeon. The first Oscar ceremony was held just over 20 years after that. Who was the first Pittsburgher to win an Oscar?
Your first Pittsburgher to win an Oscar was Selznick, David O. Selznick. He won for one of the best known. He won for Gone with the Wind. He was one of our first, you know, big Oscar winners. And it was a very different time because that was a time when, you know, the Hollywood moguls were counted as, you know, individual producers. So sometimes they would put their name on a film, but there's some great films like Casablanca that Jack Warner, who of course ran Warner Brothers, his name wasn't on the film. So he didn't count as an Oscar winner for that particular film.
Hmm. And David O. Selznick was the first, but he certainly was not the first or best-known Hollywood producer to come out of Pittsburgh. You just mentioned Jack Warner. I understand Warner Brothers got their start in our region.
They actually did. They emigrated from Poland, and you know, they bounced around a bit. They ended up in Newcastle, Pennsylvania, where they opened their first movie theater, the Cascade Theater. As Edison began charging more and more for his films and tried to basically get a lock on the industry, they realized the real money was in distribution. So they, you know, sold off the theater, moved to Pittsburgh to start the Duquesne Amusement Company and started distributing films. As they're distributing, they realized, the real money is in making films. Hmm. So they dabble a little bit while they're here in Pittsburgh, and then they
were making films here?
Just starting to dabble in it. You know, they were doing a little bit of, you know, producing, working with some smaller films, nothing big, nothing that really lasted, but it was their first experimenting with producing. And they were actually working from Pittsburgh, but doing a lot of the actual producing in New York. A lot of the films they did were in New York. And then they packed up, moved to Hollywood.
Why the West Coast? They have a problem with making a film in 7 below weather?
I think that was a part of it. And frankly, this is, you know, Hollywood was where you went. And so they packed up, opened up the Warner Brothers, and then eventually Jack Warner rather ruthlessly bought out his brothers without them knowing. And then he became the first and sort of the last of the great Hollywood moguls.
Right. Well, I guess there was a lot of that kind of thing going on, wasn't there? It was a pretty – it's always been, or at least was certainly in the heyday, the so-called heyday, a cutthroat environment.
It really, really was. It really was. And you know, he wanted to be top dog, and, you know, he did it, whatever it took.
All right. Enough about the moguls. What about the actors? What famous actors from Pittsburgh have won?
Well, you have, when you stretch sort of out to Indiana, PA, and those regions, you have sort of the most recognizable, Jimmy Stewart. You know, Jimmy Stewart was nominated 5 times.
So Indiana's part of Pittsburgh?
We sort of stretch to that Western Pennsylvania, you know. You have to reach out. But, yeah, I mean, he's, of course, you know, one best actor all these iconic characters. You know, we think of Harvey. We think of, you know, It's a Wonderful Life. He won Best Actor for Philadelphia Story back in 1940. One of the ones that's sort of, I hate to say surprising, but I think when people think of Shirley Jones, they, of course, think of the Partridge Family. But long before that, she won an Oscar for the role of Lulu Banks in Elmer Gantry. That was in 1960. She, of course, went on to fame as the you know, matriarch of the Partridge Family. But it, the thing
there was the Music Man, right?
There was the Music Man. So she had all these wholesome roles leading up to Elmer Gantry. And then in Elmer Gantry, she plays a vengeful prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's hard to imagine Mrs. Partridge as sort of this vengeful prostitute. But
became like everybody's mom.
She became like everybody's mom. She ended up making number one on the Billboard Spotlight or the Billboard Top 100, making her only the second person to Frank Sinatra, winning both an Oscar and holding the number one spot on Billboard as part of the Partridge Family.
Wow.
So she has sort of this unique bit of Oscar history.
What was the song?
I don't remember which song it was.
I think the Partridge Family
only had one big hit.
I Think I Love You?
I Think I Love You is what it was.
Brother.
Sure got it, yes.
Wow. And that stuff just never leaves your brain.
Yeah, you know, I think my favorite Oscar nominee, though, is – and he was born in Pittsburgh before moving to Texas – is F. Murray Abraham. He bounced around in these bit parts, you know, just walk-on roles. You know, played a drug dealer in, you know, Al Pacino's Scarface, but really small parts. Retires from acting, says, I'm not going to act anymore. I'm sick of this. Becomes what he called a house husband, you know, raising the kids and everything else. And then he comes back out of retirement to become the grapes from the Fruit of the Loom commercials. Okay.
I'm guessing that was before Amadeus.
It is his most iconic part. And then he's offered a role in Amadeus, wins an Oscar. So, you know, the leap can be a pretty drastic chasm that you're leaping over.
Pop culture contributor Joe Woese joining us here on Essential Pittsburgh, talking about Pittsburgh's connection to the Academy Awards. And who besides Joe would know this stuff? And you know, they call it – if you win the Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and what's the EGOT? What's the last one?
Yes, Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony.
Tony, the EGOT. So if you're number one on the Billboard charts and you win an Oscar, that's – what does that make you?
That
an O-1-er?
Close. Because she, you know, she had you know, Tony as well. I think she's pretty close to a – she had an Oscar. She had an Emmy. I believe she had a Tony. But she did not get a Grammy.
And again, she was from what area? Which part of the area?
Shirley Jones, you know, just Pittsburgh is pretty much, you know, what you have. You know, like many Pittsburghers, she moved around to different neighborhoods. I will tell you this one thing that's really interesting. At age 18, she was Miss Pittsburgh of 1952.
We talked about that when we had
her on
the
show. So I think that's better than the EGOT.
Yeah, right. That Frank Sinatra didn't win that. That's for sure. And we'll find out exactly where Shirley Jones is from, because she it was Smithton. That's what it was.
Smithton. Yes.
Thanks to our producer Marcus Charleston for pulling that out.
Good
for
job,
us.
Marcus.
Yes. Let's talk about Gene Kelly, because I noticed that he's missing from the list of Pittsburgh Oscar winners. Was he ever nominated?
Gene Kelly was nominated once for Anchors Away. He was nominated just for Anchors Away. That's it. You know, that was
not even for Singing in the Rain, or
not for Singing in the Rain. He won as Joseph Brady in 1945. That was it. In 1951, they gave him a special award, which is a non-competitive award, non-competitive Oscar, which was given to him for his versatility as an actor, singer, director, and dancer.
Well, the four-tool guy,
but
they used to call
him. Never won an Oscar for any of his other roles.
Now, William Powell, I did not know he was from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you know, it's surprising when you sort of – the further you go back, the more actors you sort of find. And William Powell, the Thin Man, I believe only nominated once but did not win. But he, you know, this.
So it was for The Thin Man?
You know, I actually don't know. I believe it was for The Thin Man. He did a lot of different things. So I'd have to, you know, he's one of those actors who you know him, to see him if you're, you know, from that generation or later and you're a fan of classic film. Mm-hmm. But I think the general public is just sort of – he's one of those legendary great actors that has just sort of faded. People don't know him as well.
Or they might confuse him with Dick Powell.
Yes,
who was not from Pittsburgh.
Who was not from Pittsburgh.
You know, there are all sorts of categories. You know, we've talked about producers and actors, but are there, you know, and there are a lot of categories. Is there one where Pittsburghers have fared best?
Yeah, Pittsburghers are really dominant in the music category. You know, bringing, you know, best song, musical score. And so you have a lot of the nominees that fell into that category and, you know, were nominated in some cases 18 times when you look at Henry Mancini. Considered one of the most prolific composers for film. Between 1952 and 1958, he had contributed music to over 100 films, including The Creature from the Black Lagoon. So he's doing all this work, not really recognized for it. And then 1958, he composes the jazzy theme to Peter Gunn, which I think we all know that theme. And then that was his first collaboration with Blake Edwards. And over the next 30 years, you know, he's nominated 18 times. He wins 4 times, all 4 for Blake Edwards films. So he had Breakfast at Tiffany's was his first.
Mm-hmm.
And then that same year, so that was musical score, same year, Moon River for Breakfast at Tiffany's. The next year, he wins again for Days of Wine and Roses. And then he wins in 1982, 20 years later, for Victor Victoria.
By the way, William Powell nominated 3 times.
3 times.
3 mm-hmm. times. Best actor in a leading role all 3 times. The first time, Life with Father, then My Man Godfrey. Or actually, the first time was for The Thin Man, which you were correct about. And then My Man Godfrey, and finally Life with Father. Alas, he never won.
Never won, yeah.
But the highlight, of course, of every Oscar ceremony is the best film category. Of the over 100 films that have been shot in our region, how many of these were Oscar winners for Best Picture?
2. And that's 2 if, again, you stretch those outlines of Pittsburgh. You have The Deer Hunter, film just out there on the edge of what we would consider Pittsburgh.
We'll count that.
We'll count that. And then Silence of the Lambs.
Right, Jonathan Demme.
Yes, so that's it, which is sort of amazing when you think of it. There's one other film that was produced in Pittsburgh, filmed in Pittsburgh, that won for a short subject documentary in 1989, and that was the story of the Johnstown Flood.
That's interesting, and one of the more obscure categories. But the people that produce those documentaries do amazing work.
Yeah, and if you go further back, what's interesting is there's a Pittsburgher who won for newsreels. So if you go back to Walton C. Ament, he was producing the sports newsreels, and he won an Oscar. So that's going all the way back to the good old newsreel days.
Well, let's go back to Best Actor very quickly because we're running out of time. And by the way, Pittsburgh native Adolphe Monjou was nominated for Best Actor in 1931 for The Front Page.
The Front Page.
That's a great film.
Great film. People probably know that story from His Girl Friday.
Right, right.
And then later, Burt Reynolds in Broadcast News. So that film has been remade multiple times. It was made again as The Front Page with Walter Matthau and Jack Lemmon. So that's a film that's just the story has been reproduced again and again.
All right. Before we let you go, down to just a few seconds, what do you think Michael Keaton's chances of winning are?
He's got it. I think he's got it this year. It was a great film. I think it was sort of one of those meta roles and fantastic. I think he's going
to
make it.
Okay. Well, we'll see how it all turns out. And Joe Woese's article, we'll have a link to it at our website, WESA.FM. Joe Woese, our culture contributor, culture vulture, I like to say. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for listening to Essential Pittsburgh. Until Monday, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everybody.